Welcome to the History of the Americans podcast, episode 148. I'm your host, Jack Henneman, and I'm recording this episode on April 15th, 2024, in New Orleans. We are telling the history of the lands now encompassed by the United States from the beginning without intentional presentism. Before we get to the history fun, a couple of items. I've added a tab to the homepage of the podcast website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com, called Timeline. The plan for that page is to create a truly chronological timeline of all the dates mentioned in the podcast. I did a dozen or so episodes this week. No promises on when it will catch up to the mid-17th century, but I'll try to work on it when I have a little downtime. Anyway, it would be great if you took a look at it and let me know whether you think it would be useful or not. Perhaps it's also worth mentioning that if you want to support the podcast in some small way, you can buy stuff through the Amazon links in the episode notes on the website. Once you click through, anything you buy, not just the book in question, gets me a small commission, which is very much appreciated. I have no plans to monetize the podcast with ads or subscriptions and stuff like that, although it's now big enough that I could. But it does cost me a few thousand bucks a year in books and hosting fees, and a little help covering that is great. The organized Puritan settlements in New England in the first half of the 17th century, Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth, and Connecticut being foremost, the New Haven colony was in some respects the most peculiar. It was probably the wealthiest of the four United Colonies on a per capita basis, the most insistent on religion's role in civil governance, and the least democratic, being basically not democratic. The men who founded it had great expectations and ambitions for geographical and commercial expansion, most of which would come to naught. As things turned out, they would have been much better off just making pizza, as anybody from New Haven, including especially Yaleys, will tell you within 17 seconds of first meeting them. The most digestible source for the history of New Haven, at least before the History of the Americans podcast got its grubby mitts on the story, was written by Edward E. Atwater in 1902, History of the Colony of New Haven to its Absorption into Connecticut. Atwater's tome runs a hefty 528 pages, excluding its many appendices. Suffice it to say that Atwater's book, useful as it is for a history podcast that tends to the arcane, falls into the category of things I read, so you don't have to. Edward Atwater seems to have been descended from some of the earliest settlers, insofar as there was an Atwater family from the first days, and his book pays attention to details that are far more interesting to locals than anybody else, such as a seating chart that explains where everybody sat in the meeting house on Sundays. He also uses old-fashioned language, such as occasionally referring to Indians as savages. Forewarned is forearmed, on the very small chance that your sensibilities in such matters are tender. This episode has no prerequisites per se, but it will be more interesting for long-standing and even mildly attentive listeners who have absorbed the rise and subsequent oppression of the Puritans in England, the causes of the English Civil War, and the first 20 years of English settlement in New England. If you feel you must prepare a bit, you might listen to our episode from 3 months back, an overview of the European settlement of the Northeast before 1650. The founders of New Haven were two lifelong friends and schoolmates, John Davenport and Theophilus Eaton. Both were born in the 1590s, and by the 1620s had become Puritan Calvinists, first quietly and then more assertively. Davenport followed the usual arc of such people. He became popular as a preacher, and then caught the attention of the traditionalists in the Church of England and had to lie low. He lived under John Cotton's protection for a while before Cotton himself emigrated to Massachusetts Bay, then fled in disguise to Holland in 1633, and apparently hung out with the Dutch master painter Rembrandt van Rijn. It has been believed that during his years in Holland, Davenport posed for Rembrandt, but modern scholars argue that those paintings were in fact self-portraits. Who knows? Regardless, Davenport stayed in touch with Puritans in England and was, along with his friend Eaton, an early investor in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He returned briefly to England in 1637, probably to arrange passage to New England during the peak of the Puritan Great Migration. Theophilus Eaton went to Oxford and became a successful merchant, part of that class of English Puritans who were regarded as particularly threatening to the established church because of their wealth. Theophilus rose quickly among the movers and shakers of early 17th century England, becoming a member of the Court of Common Council of the City of London Corporation. He served as James I's ambassador to the King of Denmark and seems to have inserted himself into the robust trade between the two countries. Here's how the learned editors of Wikipedia describe his subsequent rise. Quote, "Thereafter, Eaton would become deputy governor of the Eastland Company, which was one of the most important English commercial companies of the 17th century. The enterprise traded in the Baltics and Scandinavia, dealing with countries such as Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Prussia, and Poland. As his wealth grew, he took great interest in the plans to colonize New England. He would get his chance in 1628. He and a group of shareholders, including Sir Richard Saltonstall and Sir Henry Rosewell, bought the right to colonize the Massachusetts Bay Colony through a royal charter made by King Charles I of England." Back to me. Eaton's involvement with Massachusetts Bay went beyond mere investment. He sat on the governing council in England and probably supported the decisive transfer of the Bay Colony's charter to Boston, which would make it much more difficult for the crown, should it change its magisterial mind, to revoke it. He was also one of the owners of the Arbella, which long-standing and attentive listeners will remember as the flagship of the Winthrop fleet of 1630. Along the way, Eaton married twice, first to Grace Hiller, with whom he had two children. Both his children and his wife had died by 1626. In 1627, he married the widow Anne Yale, and thereby connected to the Yale family, the long-term consequences of which will be easy enough for even inattentive listeners to surmise. Theophilus Eaton had a younger brother, Samuel, who was a follower of Davenport. In 1632, about a year before Davenport fled to Holland, Bishop Laud's High Commission imprisoned Samuel and another nonconforming clergyman, John Lathrop, for holding conventicles, the term used for unlawful gatherings of religious people. There's some evidence that he continued services while in jail, probably in conspiracy with the jailers, and were eventually released on bail. Lathrop took off for New England as soon as he could. Samuel now had a strong motive for doing so himself. It's not clear, however, when Samuel and his wealthy brother began to plan their move to New England, and when they involved Davenport. We do know, however, that after fits and starts, they organized a voyage on the good ship Hector, which departed England with another small ship for Boston in late April 1637, with perhaps 250 passengers in total, including women, children, and servants. This was propitious timing, because on April 30th, 1637, Charles I imposed exit restrictions that would have prevented the ships from departing without explicit permission. Why did the Crown want to stop Puritans from moving to Massachusetts? You would think, after all, that the king would be delighted for them to leave. In a few years, he might have wished that more of them had. But Archbishop Laud was going to a lot of trouble to suppress Puritanism, and it annoyed him that they kept slipping out of his grasp. After all, Massachusetts was English territory, and nonconformity there, largely outside of his grasp, was no less a problem than nonconformity in England. Perhaps more importantly, the Puritans were disproportionately rich, and wealth taken out of the country could not then be taxed. The crown was financially strapped because it was trying to finance itself without the parliament, as long-standing and attentive listeners know, and it did not need all those rich Puritans moving to the 17th century equivalent of Florida and Texas. The Hector and its consort arrived in Boston on June 26, 1637. John Winthrop was back in the governor's office, having replaced Sir Henry Vane while the Hector was at sea. Long-standing listeners will remember that Vane had been a supporter of both Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson. Both had challenged the Bay Colony's requirement for religious conformity. Williams had already been exiled, and Hutchinson would be within the year. The community of saints in the Bay needed some healing. The arrival of John Davenport would have been, to some, a godsend, pun intended. Davenport was a Puritan minister of the stature of John Cotton, and he was also new blood, untainted by any previous position taken on Williams or Hutchinson. The people of Boston welcomed Davenport and his followers, hoping he could help stitch together the tears that had opened up in the antinomian controversy. Atwater describes Davenport's immediate influence, quote, "A synod of all the teaching elders in the country was called to discuss the questions at issue and discriminate between truth and error. Of this assembly, which began at sessions August 30th, Davenport was one of the most influential members. The wisdom and learning of this worthy man," says Mather, that would be Cotton Mather in his subsequent history of the period, "did contribute more than a little to dispel the fascinating mists which had suddenly disordered our affairs." A few days after the adjournment, Davenport, by request of the Synod, preached a sermon in which, in the words of John Winthrop, "with much wisdom and sound argument, he persuaded to unity." Back to me. Welcome as they were in Boston, Davenport's followers wanted to build their own colony, rather than settling, as it were, for the rules of the Massachusetts Bay. The question was where? The Pequot War was close to its conclusion, and in the fighting of it, the Puritans of Boston had seen a place called Quinnipiac and learned about the geography of western Connecticut. On August 31, 1637, the day after the aforementioned synod gathered, Theophilus Eaton led a group of the Hector men to explore the coast of Connecticut west of Fort Saybrook, which sat at the mouth of the Connecticut River. Eaton and his men reached the fair harbor of Quinnipiac still in September and must have spent a few weeks exploring the area before concluding that it was ripe for settlement. The harbor was large and deep, which made it suitable for the trade the wealthy men in the group expected to pursue. There were inland meadows suitable for farming and large forests to supply timber. The Indians in the area were few and had been formerly subject to the Pequots and were now threatened by Mohawk raids, and so welcomed the English in the hope of mutual defense. Having concluded that Quinnipiac would be the site of the new colony, Eaton left seven men behind to spend the winter of 1637-38 building a common house and making other preparations. One of the men died. His skeleton was supposedly discovered in 1750, during the digging of a cellar in the middle of New Haven. Don't ask me how they knew it was the dude from that first lonely winter in Quinnipiac. The rest of the Hector's 250 or so colonists stayed in Boston and its environs during the winter, recorded as one of the really difficult ones in 17th century New England. John Winthrop wrote that snow covered the ground in Massachusetts from November 4th to March 23rd. When spring came, the group had swelled to more than 400. Around 150 godly citizens of the Bay Colony wanted a new start, or to get away from the division of the antinomian controversy, or who were attracted to the rigid theology that Davenport preached, joined the migration to Quinnipiac. In late March or early April 1638, Davenport's enlarged flock sailed the coast from Boston to Quinnipiac, taking perhaps 2 weeks. That being a distance of only 160 or so statute miles by sea, it stands to reason that they stopped at various points along the way, perhaps calling on Rhode Island and Saybrook. In any case, they arrived at Quinnipiac in mid-April and had their first Sabbath service under an immense oak tree. They spent the summer acquiring land, organizing the town, and building shelter. Within a couple of years, Quinnipiac, soon to be New Haven, would have some of the largest houses in English North America. Eaton's house would have 19 fireplaces, and Davenport's 13, both with large footprints and second floors. But it took a while to build those proper houses, and even from the vantage point of spring, winter would be on them soon enough. Many of the new residents built, quote, cellars in the sides of hills to make it through that first year. On November 24, 1638, the informal deal for land reached with the various local tribes or bands was memorialized in a deed, its preamble reading, quote, Articles of Agreement between Theophilus Eaton and John Davenport and others, English planters at Quinnipiac on the one party, and Momagan, the Indian sachem of Quinnipiac, and Secaugsin, Quessaquash, Carrowhood, Weesacock, and others of his council on the other party, made and concluded the 24th of November, 1638, Thomas Staunton being interpreter. Back to me. As we have seen and will see again, the English were not much for Indian deeds as a means for legitimizing a colony. Colonies needed authorization from the crown by one means or another, a corporate charter, a proprietary grant, or direct control by the crown. Massachusetts Bay and Plymouth had charters. Rhode Island didn't in 1638, but as long-standing and attentive listeners well know, Roger Williams would secure one in 1644, outmaneuvering Hugh Peter in London to do it. Maryland was a proprietary colony owned by Lord Baltimore, and Virginia was, after May 24, 1624, a crown colony. The colony that Eaton and Davenport were planning at Quinnipiac had none of these things, which would eventually become a problem. However, Indian deeds were recognized by the Dutch, whose claim extended from the Delaware River to the Connecticut River. Eaton and Davenport were building evidence that would help them in a legal fight, at a minimum, with the governor of New Amsterdam. And, of course, it's also possible that Eaton and Davenport thought it was right and proper to pay the Indians for their land, as at least some other English, Roger Williams and William Pynchon come to mind, argued was necessary. The price in material terms was the usual stuff, quote, 12 coats of English trucking cloth, 12 alchemy spoons, 12 hatchets, 12 hoes, 2 dozen of knives, 12 porringers, and 4 cases of French knives and scissors. Such a deal. Actually very useful to the tribes. In fairness, the deed also spelled out the rules of engagement between the local tribes and the English, including obligations to turn over criminals, a mutual defense pact under prescribed circumstances, a requirement that Indians not kill English cattle, and that the English keep their livestock out of Indian fields, and that the Indians steer clear of the town on the Sabbath. The so-called deed was, therefore, more of a peace treaty and non-aggression pact than a transfer of land, just as Indians often understood such transactions to be. The next 2 years, 1639 and 1640, were defining ones for the settlers of Quinnipiac, for they would establish their government, build their first church, set up satellite settlements throughout the region, and change the name of the colony to New Haven. One might reasonably wonder why the establishment of the government took more than a year from the arrival of the settlers from Boston in the spring of 1638. In all likelihood, the delay derived from a disagreement over whether freemen who were not members of the church would be allowed to vote in the elections for the members of the general court. Remember, this did not mean churchgoers, because membership was limited to revealed saints. In order to be admitted as a member of the church, you had to be determined to be among the godly elect, a much higher hurdle, and especially so in John Davenport's conception of it. In most of New England, the franchise had been slowly expanded, either by allowing freemen who were not church members to vote, as in Plymouth Colony and Providence, or because some churches were simply more liberal about admitting new members, and that had the practical effect of expanding the franchise. At a meeting on June 4, 1639, the leading freemen in Quinnipiac gathered to consider who would actually have a voice in running the colony. Reverend Davenport framed the discussion by posing a series of questions, quote, praying for them to consider seriously in the presence and fear of God the weight of the business they met about, and not to be rash or slight in giving their voice to things they understand not. In other words, the minister that they had followed to the edge of the wilderness was now suggesting rather strongly that they defer to his expertise. Davenport's queries, as they were described, are worth summarizing. Try to imagine yourself in the meeting house and the pressure there might have been to conform. Query 1. Whether the scriptures do hold forth a perfect rule for the direction and government of all men in all duties, which they are to perform to God and men, as well as in the government of families and commonwealths as in matters of the church. Slam dunk on that one, quote, "This was assented by all, no man dissenting. The Bible would be the perfect and exclusive book of laws." Query 2. Whether there was a covenant solemnly made by the whole assembly of free planters, the first day of extraordinary humiliation which we had after we came together, that is, in matters that concern the gathering and ordering of a church, so likewise in all public offices which concern civil order, as choice of magistrates and officers, making and repealing of laws, dividing allotments of inheritance, and all things of like nature, we would all of us be ordered by those rules which the Scripture holds forth to us, and whether everybody still held themselves bound by that covenant. Well, yes, those that had been present back when they embarked on the mission had all gone along with that stuff. Now those that had not been, looking around the room, decided it would be smart to do so as well. Query 3. That all y'all free planters have the purpose, resolution, and desire to be one day admitted into church fellowship according to Christ as soon as God shall fit them thereunto. Well, nobody was going to admit that they did not so desire. Left out, of course, is who on this earth would determine when God concludes that a man is fit. In all likelihood, most of the people in the room knew it would be Davenport. Having established that everybody believed that the Bible was the perfect source of all law for all time, that everybody had agreed to act accordingly already, and that everybody wanted to be church members when God saw fit, Davenport sprung his trap. Skipping some tedious detail to get to query 5, quote, "Whether free burgesses shall be chosen out of church members, and the power of choosing magistrates and officers from among themselves, and the power of making and repealing laws according to the word, and the dividing of inheritances, and deciding of differences that may arise, and all the business of like nature, are to be transacted by those free burgesses." Back to me. In other words, not only would magistrates and officers all be church members, only church members could choose magistrates and officers. To this there was a sole objection from Samuel Eaton, he who had done his time in jail in England and carried on his ministry even then. His voice did not carry the day. The tricky part, however, was there being no physical church and everybody having been consumed with building houses and planting crops and whatnot. It was not clear who among them was a revealed saint and therefore a member of the church. To do this, the settlers gathered into neighborhood caucuses and sorted it out. Here's the description from Atwater, quoting some uncited narrative, quote, "Mr. Davenport advised that the names of such as were to be admitted might be publicly propounded, to the end that they who were most approved might be chosen, for the town being cast into several private meetings, wherein they that dwelt nearest together gave their accounts one to another of God's gracious work upon them, and prayed together, and conferred to their mutual edification. Sundry of them acknowledged one of another, and in every meeting some one was more approved of all than any other. For this reason, and to avoid scandals, the whole company was entreated to consider whom they found fittest to nominate for this work." Back to me. This was in effect a means to secure popular buy-in for the first group of church members, who would thereafter make every meaningful public decision in the colony, including the admission of new members. There were 12 of them, including, of course, Davenport and Theophilus Eaton. The church was established on August 22, 1639, and by October 25th, the 12 had settled on 7 among them to hold public office. Therefore, by late 1639, Quinnipiac Colony had picked a small group of men to govern the colony strictly in accordance with the scriptures. Furthermore, since the scriptures were unchanging, the general laws would be unchanging. The colony's adherence to this principle was so strict that even ancient trappings of English legal tradition preserved elsewhere in New England had no home in New Haven. Since God had not mentioned trial by a jury, there would be no trial by a jury. The magistrates would decide all, including who else might be admitted to the church and therefore allowed to participate in the selection of magistrates. Edward Atwater, in general a New Haven booster, concludes his chapter on the formation of the intertwined church and government with an anecdote, quote, "The formal institution of civil authority may have been hastened by foresight of an event which immediately followed. The next day, after the magistrate had been clothed with power, an Indian named Nepapunk was brought before him upon his warrant, charged with the murder of an Englishman at Wethersfield on the Connecticut River. A few days afterward, a general court was assembled, and the prisoner was brought before it for trial. Being found guilty upon evidence so clear that he confessed his guilt, he was condemned to death. Accordingly, his head was cut off the next day and pitched upon a pole in the marketplace." Back to me. Apparently, the general court saw no need to consider that the crime was not committed within the jurisdiction of Quinnipiac, and that perhaps Nepapunk should just be extradited to Wethersfield. Anyway, during 1640, the now organized town began to build infrastructure and allocate land among the original settlers. It also went about recruiting more people. Probably to that end, on September 1, 1640, it renamed the colony New Haven. This was a departure from the much more frequent practice of naming new towns after sister cities in Old England, or with straight-up religious implications, such as Providence. But the rise of the Puritans in England had diminished their oppression, and the colony needed to do some marketing. That same summer, Samuel Eaton, the man who had argued without success that non-church members should have the vote, returned to England for the purpose of recruiting more settlers. He found that his old friends, who might well have been interested a few years before, now preferred to stay home and fight the good fight. Samuel decided to stay as well, and sent his brother Theophilus a power of attorney to sell his property in the New World. Still, the colony attracted new settlers from elsewhere in New England. One of them, Edward Hopkins from Hartford, would eventually leave the bequest that established the Hopkins Grammar School of New Haven, which still operates today, 364 years after its founding, and by reputation as a rather tony private school. Its annual tuition listed at $58,850 for the 2023-24 academic year. Before financial aid, of course. The odds are there are alumni of the school among our listeners. Isaac Allerton also moved to New Haven. He'd come over on the Mayflower in 1620, but had left New Plymouth under a cloud for business dealings that William Bradford had thought shady. He'd spent the intervening years in Salem, and now came to New Haven, perhaps because it was loaded with wealthy and aspiring merchants. Having witnessed essentially the entire New English experience over 20 years, he was no doubt welcome for his deep knowledge of regional trading. Almost from the beginning, New Haven spun off new towns in western Connecticut and even Long Island. They were Milford, Guilford, Southold, and Stamford, and at one point or another all subjected themselves to the jurisdiction of New Haven Colony rather than Connecticut Colony. In the interest of neurotic completeness, we'll run through them to conclude this episode. As early as late 1639, more than 50 of the original settlers moved to a place called Wepawag, which is about 10 miles southwest of New Haven along the coast. Apologies for pronunciation and so forth. Their government had the same structure as at New Haven. Word of God, only church members can vote, blah, blah, blah. But with a crucial practical difference. At Wepawag, 44 out of 54 of the original planters were church members, and so were both enfranchised and eligible to serve. Within 3 years, the settlement would allow freemen who were not church members to vote, although not serve. At the Second General Court of Wepawug on March 9, 1640, it was agreed that when William Fowler would build a mill for grinding grain, which should be ready for the fall harvest. This was the first within the notional jurisdiction of New Haven Colony, and considered so significant that at the General Court of November 24, 1640, the town changed its name to Milford. As with New Haven, there's no evidence that anybody had an objection to the Indian name per se, having been using it happily for some time, but rather to get the word out to new settlers. Also in the summer of 1639, a couple of ships arrived with passengers from Kent under the leadership of Henry Whitfield. Their plan from the beginning was to form their own town in the vicinity of Quinnipiac, and after a arrival, determined to buy land from the Indians at a place about 10 miles east of New Haven, which I pronounce Menencatuck, or maybe Menencatuck. This they did from a sachem squaw of the people living there, the price being 12 each of coats, fathoms of wampum, glasses, pairs of shoes, hatchets, stockings, hose, knives, hats, porringers, and spoons, and 4 kettles. This area they came to call Guilford, provenance of the name unknown, at least to me. We know very little about Guilford's early days. The first listing of planters that survive is dated 1650, but we know that the town started a church on June 19, 1643, and that among its members was William Leet, who would go on to become the governor of New Haven Colony. Guilford, along with Milford, became part of New Haven Colony with the formation of the United Colonies of New England in May 1643, presumably because that would give them the benefits of the Mutual Defense Pact. In 1639 or 1640, the timing's not clear, yet another company of settlers came, this time from Norfolkshire, England, under the Reverend John Youngs, who'd been in correspondence with Davenport. They would go on to settle in Southold, which is on the eastern part of Long Island across the Sound, just south of Fort Saybrook, and just to the west of Shelter Island. Southold subjected itself to the jurisdiction of New Haven, 31 miles to the northwest as the fairly robust crow flies, from the very beginning. The last of the 4 early spin-offs was Stamford, about 35 miles southwest up the Long Island Sound from New Haven, and now famous to fans of hedge funds the world round. The most curiously named of these, by the way, was Pequot Capital Management in Westport. I'm not sure I would name a hedge fund after a tribe that had been rather ingloriously wiped out, especially if my offices were not even on the tribe's erstwhile territory. Pequot Capital wasn't exactly wiped out, but it was effectively shut down during the global financial crisis by an SEC investigation for insider trading. Then again, there are no doubt hedge fund executives who think of the SEC as the Puritan killjoys of our era. Anyway, on July 1, 1640, Captain Turner, acting as agent for the General Court of New Haven, purchased the territory for the purpose of future settlement. On November 4, 1640, the General Court flipped the Stamford property, presumably without having fixed it up, to Andrew Ward and Robert Coe, who were the representatives of 22 families in Wethersfield, Connecticut Colony, who wanted to set up a new town under New Haven, preferring the theocracy, or at least the teaching, of John Davenport to the slightly more relaxed religion and government that prevailed on the Connecticut River. Next time, we will gallop through the various governance and commercial crises that afflicted New Haven Colony, including one of early America's first ghost stories. Thank you again for listening to the History of the Americans podcast. Your email has been very encouraging. Please keep them coming. You can reach me with questions, corrections, eruptions of indignation, or pats on the back on the contact page for the website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com, or by email at thehistoryoftheamericans@gmail.com. And please do me the great favor of giving the podcast a 5-star rating on Apple, if the spirit moves you, and following me on the Facebook page for the podcast and on X, for my musings on mostly history-related matters. Until next time.